Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Rose Quinn Podcast. We took a break last week, but we are back with the we. You guys, why do I keep saying we? It's just me here. I took a break last week, and now this episode, the guest is Gretchen McNeil, who I was so stoked to get to interview her because I've read a couple of her books, and she's just like the horror queen. And I love everything that I've read of hers. But before we get to Gretchen, which we will, and it's a wonderful conversation, I want to talk to you about one of her books. It's my favorite book of the episode. It's Hashtag Murder Trending. I'm pretty sure I posted about it when it came out as well on my Instagram. But it was just kind of like a new kind of horror book, which I love that horror is such a YA thing right now, and that there's so many more books coming out that are what I would have wanted to read in high school. And everybody reads YA, not just high school kids. But Hashtag Murder Trending is, it's a little, you know, it's not horror set in like our world. That's what I think is so great about horror, and we'll talk about that later. But before I get ahead of myself, let's just read the blurb. Welcome to the near future, where good and honest citizens can enjoy watching the executions of society's most infamous convicted felons, streaming live on the Postman app from the suburbanized Prison Island Alcatraz 2.0. When 17-year-old Dee Guerrera wakes up in a haze, lying on the ground of a dimly lit warehouse, she realizes she's about to be the next victim of the app. Knowing hardened criminals are getting a taste of their own medicine in this place is one thing, but Dee refuses to roll over and die for a heinous crime she didn't commit. Can Dee and her newly formed posse, the Death Row Breakfast Club, prove she's innocent before she ends up wrongfully murdered for the world to see? Or will the Postman's cast of executioners kill them off one by one? When I saw the blurb for this book, and I'm pretty sure I got an arc of it, which was so lucky, I was just like, this looks incredible. And it did not disappoint. It was super popular when it came out and is such a blast to read. It's real creepy, real different, and like a future you would never want to be a part of, right? That sounds terrible, to be on an island with convicted criminals who are trying to kill you. Well, there's a sequel coming out, and it is actually already out. I'm recording this before, so I have to make sure I get my dates right. But yeah, it came out on August 6th of this year, and it's called Hashtag Murder Funding, and it is pretty awesome. So let's read the blurb for that real quick. Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Paniac, the latest reality TV show on the hunt for the next big hit serial killer. But don't worry, no one is actually going to murder anyone, as real as the fake gore and pretend murder may appear. Right? 17-year-old Becca Martinello is about to find out. When her perfectly normal soccer mom dies in a car crash, a strange girl named Steph appears and lets Becca know that her deceased mom was none other than one of Alcatraz 2.0's most popular serial killers, Molly Mahler. Soon, Becca ends up on Who Wants to Be a Paniac to learn the truth about her mom's connection to Molly. But things turn sinister when people are murdered in real life. Will Becca uncover dark secrets and make it out of the deadly reality show alive, or will she get cut? Again, Gretchen is incredible, and these books are so fun, and, you know, they've got the horror and murder part of it, but they're not, like, I would say super dark, like you're sitting there super terrified the whole entire time. There's humor, there's good friend relationships, there's a lot, so Gretchen does a wonderful job. I also have reviewed and talked about one of her books, 10, that I really loved. Everything that she's written, you should go back and read because she's incredible. But I wanted to do a little lit chit-chat about why YA horror is the best. I grew up watching horror movies, which might not have been my parents' best decision, but the Scream series and Poltergeist were a part of my childhood. Poltergeist still terrifies me to this day. But I was a sucker for the horror in Buffy the Vampire Slayer and everything else about that show because it's wonderful. And I love Supernatural, the TV show, and things that are supernatural. So when I started to see this, like, this upswing in amazing YA horror books, I was in awe. I bought way too many of them and fell down a slasher murder horror pit. But I love that this is something other authors are writing about and that agents are recognizing there's a desire for and that publishers are buying and putting out there. Because I think a lot of people love horror. And I think the thing that's so cool is that horror is so versatile. It's not its own genre, I think. It's a more of a feeling. It's something that you can put into science fiction, you can put it into paranormal, fantasy, contemporary, or anything else you can think of. You could have horror in any kind of genre. So, you know, kids like serial killers, crime, scary stories, ghosts, and everything else creepy that you could think of. And it's nice that there are horror stories written in the YA world. I would have loved to read something like hashtag murder trending or Stephanie Perkins, There's Someone Inside Your House, which is such a cool slasher book. I would have loved to have read those when I was in high school. Instead, I read true crime books, books about FBI profilers, and biographies on serial killers. Both are great choices, but I think sometimes the fiction could be a little bit healthier. I would never give up any of my serial killer knowledge. I think it helps in my writing process now, but my parents, I don't think, were thrilled that that's the kind of stuff I was reading when I was a kid. So I just love horror. If you love horror, scream it, talk about it. Let's let editors and publishers know that we want it so that more people can put their horror out there. Because I, frankly, want to see it all. I want to see all the horror stories. And I just love seeing writers like Rebecca Schaefer or Stephanie Perkins, Gretchen, bringing creepy, bloody stories to life. Okay, now let's get to know Gretchen McNeil. She's a wonderful author and shares some super great knowledge and tips and, you know, her journey throughout her published career. So without further ado, here is Gretchen. First of all, I found you when I read, when I got an arc of Murder Trending, which was incredible, and then I read 10, and I just feel like you write such great, like, horror, slasher, bloody YA novels, which is, like, everything I wanted when I was a young adult.
Yes, me too!
Right? They're so good. So what brought you to, I mean, like, you just wanted to see that in writing, or do you have, like, a passion for that sort of thing? Because I think that stuff is so cool.
Well, it's pretty much exactly what you said, which is when I was a teen, I wanted to read those books. And I'm significantly older than you, so when I was a teen, there was no YA. There was no section of books specifically for teens. It was sort of all jumbled together under Kidlit, and so you'd go into the stacks at the library, and it would be, you know, early Judy Blume,
yeah,
things like Forever, and the only sort of, like, YA horror novels that we had were contemporary. This was, you know, in the 80s and 90s, was Christopher Pike, and Lois Duncan to a lesser extent, only because she didn't have as many books out, but, you know, Christopher Pike had a book out every year. They had those splashy neon, you know, spray paint looking covers, and that was sort of my introduction to contemporary horror. Mostly, what I read though back in those days were Victorian love stories, Edwardian, kind of gothic books. I think the Bronte's, yeah, sort of were an entry drug for that for me. And so I read, like, the short stories of Sheridan Le Fanu and Amber Bierce and people like that. because there wasn't, like I said, anything that was sort of speaking to that need for creepy, scary things, you know, that were geared towards teenagers at the time. Yeah. So when I started writing, and my first book was like an adult rom-com that I like to joke was neither romantic nor funny. but I know it's true. It's true. And no one can dispute that. No one will ever read it. But I tried to get an agent for that book, and I was rejected by literally everybody. But a couple of agents suggested that the tone of writing was more appropriate for YA. Now, again, there was no YA when I was young, so I went to the bookstore, and I was like, wow, look at this entire section of books for teenagers. And I grabbed a few, and I read them, and I realized that the tone and style and voice of my writing, all of which I do feel is sort of intrinsic to the writer a little bit. It's not really something that you can teach someone. It's just the way the words come out of you when you start writing was very much that of a 16-year-old. And so my next book that I wrote was YA, and it was the right fit. It was the right story, the right age group, the right voice. And so when I was writing for teens, and my first YA novel landed me an agent but did not get me a book. Okay. And when I sat down to write my what would be my second YA novel, I was really thinking hard about what I loved back, you know, eons ago when I was a teenager. And it was scary movies. And it was watching, you know, when I was a young kid, it was a movie like Clue, which is not really a horror movie, but, you know, is scary for, like, a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
And I moved into things like Rosemary's Baby and then, of course, The Exorcist. And The Exorcist scared the pants off me as a kid. Like, I don't know what my cousin was babysitting me and somehow thought it was appropriate to put that on. And this was like the TV edit, because this is back in the day, and just terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
And so I decided that, you know, that was where my interest, you know, was in terms of writing for teens, because a lot of the things that had scared me when I was younger, whether it was vampires or werewolves or, you know, ghost zombies, whatever, had all been romanticized, which is totally and completely fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I prefer, like, the Nosferatu vampire, like, the scary.
Yes.
And so that is what I want. That's what I set out to accomplish with Possessed, which was my first young adult horror novel. And I think Murder Trending is sort of the culmination of my love for things that are gory and over the top, but also the humor, the natural humor that I write, and to be able to put those two things together, first of all, the salty and the sweet, you know, of comedy and gore are such a great combination, but to be able to do that and to have a publisher who understood what I was trying to do and let me go a little bit off the rails with this one was just, like, so, they trusted me so much, and they believed in this book, and I wasn't quite sure if it was going to find an audience, but I'm super, super grateful that that people enjoy and read it with a sense of both fun and sort of foreboding that I was trying to get into it.
Yeah, I was definitely one of those kids. I loved horror. I watched Poltergeist at a very young age.
Yes, oh, and that's a great one.
Oh my gosh, that scared the crap out of me. So terrifying. But then I just have always loved, like, my parents let me watch the Scream movies way too young, but now I, you know, have just a love for all those things. So this book, Murder Trending, was that perfect mix of horror, real scary, but, you know, got that comedic relief in it a little bit, but it was so good. So, and then 10 was great. Love the slasher feel of it. I didn't realize that there was that many horror YA books out there, so it was, like, exciting for me, too. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is great. I love it, you know.
Yeah, I love how many different types of horror, like, YA encompasses, because you've got supernatural horror, you've got more traditional ghost stories, you've got slasher, you've got haunted houses. I mean, really, if you look at what's out there in the genre, it's quite expansive, and I think it's really exciting.
Oh, it's so exciting. I love that kids love that sort of stuff, too, which I, you know.
And that librarians support it. And yes. I owe so much of the success, whatever success I've had in this business, but I owe so much of it to librarians who have supported my books and encouraged teens to read them. And I think, you know, the reluctant reader list for YALSA, which I'm lucky enough to make with two different books, really highlights this importance of genre for young readers, because too often between middle school and high school, you know, in that 2 or 3 year time period of middle school, we lose readers, right? Yeah. Kids go from reading kids' books, and which, you know, we're much more gender inclusive, right?
Yeah.
where YA, especially until the last couple of years, was really geared toward girls, teenage girls, and you lose a lot of readers.
Yeah.
Not just boys, but the girls who were maybe not interested in romance. And so the horror, and other genres too, offers a sort of romance-free zone. you know, books that don't have girls in prom dresses on the cover, that, you know, a boy who's maybe struggling with feeling cool enough to and confident enough to read a book like that can pick up 10 or Murder Trending and not worry about what's on the cover.
Yeah.
But also quick reads that move quickly and take place over just like 2 or 3 days and just focus on, you know, adventure stuff. I think there's a readership that needs that. And librarians, because they're on the front lines of seeing exactly what kids are and aren't reading, know what type of books to put in the hands of the reader. And I've just been so, so lucky that they continue to support what I'm doing.
Yes, and I think librarians are a special type of people. I would love to work in a library. I think that'd be fun.
I do not have the patience for it, and I don't nor teaching, but I am eternally grateful for both, for teachers and librarians, oh, and yeah. Teacher librarians, the ones that do both.
Yes, my best friend is a teacher, and I used to think I wanted to be a teacher, but after seeing her and the patience she has to have, I'm like, no, I could never do that. I would rip my hair out.
Yeah. And in some ways, it's so thankless. I mean, yeah. My mother is a retired teacher, taught for 40 plus years, and so many rewarding things happened to her. And, you know, kids that would come back as parents, that she had that with parents that had kids they wanted to have in her classroom. It's all wonderful. But there's also a thanklessness to it of parents who feel like they can dictate your job to you because they know their kid better. And I'm not saying that parents don't know their children better. I'm a mom, get it. But yeah. You have to let teachers do their job. And I feel often that the teacher is regarded as like a necessary evil as opposed to, you know, a blessing of a first world society that can afford to give its citizens a free education.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm so excited for Murder Funding to come out in August, but I want to go back a little bit. Tell us about your journey to getting published. So you said that first book, you got an agent, but you didn't get a book deal. Did you keep that same agent throughout?
I do. Okay. I do. I have the same agent that I signed with way, way back at the end of 2008. We just celebrated our 10-year anniversary.
That's awesome.
Which means I've been with my agent longer than either of my husbands. so we, you know, I had the exact opposite experience querying that YA novel that I had from querying Don't Rock, which was, I think it was 134 rejections or no non-responses for the adult book. And I had 4 offers of representation for the YA. I had them within a week.
Wow.
Which was crazy. Yeah. I mean, completely crazy. And I chose the agent that I thought would be the best fit for my personality. And I do not regret that decision at all. Ginger Clark and I have had a wonderful, wonderful working relationship. And she's not just been a conduit to getting a book deal. She's been someone who's helped guide and sort of shape my career in ways that I consider myself, you know, so blessed to have. That said, that first book that she signed me for went up for submission in 2009, which is when the publishing industry contracted. There were a lot of layoffs, a lot of changes in publishing that went along with the global recession we were having.
Yeah.
And I do not mean to blame that on the fact that I did not get a book deal. I'm sure there were many reasons why I did not get a book deal that might have contributed to it. Or it might just have been that the book was not right for a marketplace that was saturated with young adult urban fantasy, which is what that book was.
Yeah.
We got close a couple times, but it didn't sell. And instead of sort of sitting around and like licking my wounds over my brilliant book that would never be read by anyone, Ginger really encouraged me to write another book. And I said, well, you know, I've been toying around with this like young adult exorcist thing. And she was like, write that book, write it now. And I did. In fact, I wrote the first 50,000 words for NaNoWriMo in November of 2009, and which I'll never do again because 50,000 words in a month is not healthy for me.
It's so many words for 1 month.
It's so many words. And look, I have written books on very tight deadlines. I wrote 10 in 10 weeks. I wrote Murder Trending in 10 weeks.
Wow.
But somehow, but you know, that was later in my career after done a book or two, and Possessed being like only the third novel that I'd written. You know, I wrote 50,000 words in November, and then I did write it all in December. And then in January of 2010, I sort of picked it up and finished it, and I think I sent it to Ginger in like late early March, something like that. And then we did some revisions, and it went out on submission, and you know, we got a lot of rejections. Horror is still one of those things that makes people nervous, like, because yeah, they're not sure that it's going to find an audience. I am like, teens love horror, come on. But
get with the program.
I know, come on, like, look at the box office. But
right,
we had one editor at Balzer and Bray who loved it and wanted me to do some revision, and so I did. I revised like the first, I don't know, 50 pages, something like that, and sent it in based on her feedback, and I got a book offer. And that was in like July of 2010, and it came out in August of 2011, really, really fast. And they, Balzer and Bray for HarperCollins, Kristen Daly Renn, whom I adore, they really believed in me, and they stuck with me for 7 books before we parted ways amicably. It's like an amicable divorce. But divorce is not the right word, though, because I'm convinced that someday, you know, I will have another book with them. But for now, Disney was just a better fit for Murder Trending, for that type of, like, super highly commercial, way over the top, kind of bridges, like, it's definitely upper YA, you know, not for sexual content, of which there is none, you know, but for the gore, and to be able to do that. I mean, there are some things in this book that I really kept thinking they were going to say, no, you can't do that. You can't recreate a scene from Zoolander or a scene from Die Hard. You can't do that. And, you know, Nobody said a word. And it just, I feel like it was the right fit with Freeform kind of aiming for an upper YA audience, and you know, sort of my sensibilities for this genre sort of leaning in that direction. And I've just, you know, I've been super lucky that there have been editors, first Kristen at Balzer and Bray, and now Kieran Viola at Freeform, who love horror and murder mystery and grew up reading Agatha Christie like I did, and so they get that.
Yeah.
And I'm incredibly grateful that I've been allowed to continue to do this I mean, The Funding is going to be my ninth book. It's completely insane.
I have one more that I just
I'm waiting on revisions for right now. That'll be my 2020 novel. That'll be 10 books.
Wow.
And I'm just, like, you know, I'm not a New York Times bestseller. I am not, like, you know, that marquee author that gets blown around the world and people know their name and, you know, ends up as a question on Jeopardy. Like, I'm not that person. And yet, you know, I'm still here. I'm still publishing. And I think that's a wonderful testament to the business that it's not just about bestsellers. Like, there's room for a lot of different careers and a lot of different types of books and a lot of different definitions of success. And I'm sort of the beneficiary of that, I think.
Yeah, that is awesome. That is quite the accomplishment. 10 books published.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you queried and had to send out the lovely query letter, how did you approach that? It's the worst. It actually is the worst. But how did you approach that horrible process?
Well, here's the lesson I learned in researching how to write a query letter. And, you know, talk about going back in time. When I was querying that first book, the adult rom-com, so that would have been like late 2007, early 2008, a lot of agents didn't accept email queries. You had to mail in a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope, like it was 1995. I think I was still getting, like, rejections
in the mail, in
my address stamped envelope back in the mail long after I had published. So, which is just crazy, right?
That is crazy.
So, the thing about queries that is the most important, and I teach writing now here in LA, and I try to do a class on writing queries and synopses. I think it's so important, and it really is kind of an art form in and of itself.
Sure is, yeah.
A query is a pitch. It is not a synopsis. It is what you would put on the back cover of to entice someone to pick it up. And in that, you have to accomplish three major things. You have to tell us who the main character is, right?
Mm-hmm.
What it is that they want, why they want it, and then what is at stake if they fail. You don't have to tell us the ending of the book. You've got to tease. You've got to be like, you know, if they don't find the secret to XYZ, the fate of humanity is at hand.
Right.
Or, if she can't learn to trust someone else, will she ever be able to find love? Whatever it is. But that's it. Who's the main character? What do they want? And why do they want it? In acting, they would call that the objective and the motivation. And then what is at stake if they fail? You don't need to introduce every main character. You just need to introduce really the main character. If the love interest is important, if the love interest is the story, then you need to introduce that. And potentially an antagonist. I mean, that's it. And you can do that in 250 words, as long as you're not trying to synopsize the entire book.
Right. Which is what a lot of people try and do in a query.
Well, you want to, because right. You feel like the brilliance of what you've written needs to be explained, but it's not, that's not what a query is, that's what a synopsis is. A query is really a tease. You want to entice someone to read more. That's it. When I was, after I got divorced from my first, I was sort of jumping back to the dating pool. I read a book about first dates and basically what first dates are. And it's not, you're not trying to assess whether this is someone you want to spend the rest of your life with. You're just trying to assess if you could handle a second date with them. An agent in reading a query is not trying to decide whether or not they're going to sign you and work with you for a decade. They're just trying to figure out if they want to read a little bit more, whether that's the synopsis, first three chapters, the first half, whatever. That's it. Hmm. And you just want to entice them.
Yeah.
To read more.
I think that is something that we all need to be reminded of. I just read somebody
who posted their query. I think it was on Twitter or something. They're asking for beta readers, but it was like character soup. There was like 10 characters and I was getting real lost and I was like, okay, that's the whole problem with queries.
Yes, and especially like any book that has a lot of characters. Like, I didn't have to query 10, obviously, but if I was writing a query for 10, it would just be about Meg.
Yeah.
And then I would maybe mention Minnie and or TJ, sort of depending. I, you know, again, I didn't have to write a query for it. But really, it's just about Meg. It's about Meg trying to solve a problem to keep herself and her friends alive, to figure out who's trying to kill them and why.
Yeah.
So a query would be setting them up on the island, like, get them to the island. Why are they there? What happens when they get there? They start to realize that they're, you know, things are a little odd. And then once people start dying, it's really just, can she figure out why they've been brought there, who's killing them, and why, before there's no one left to tell the tale.
Yeah.
Those are the stakes, right? That's it. I need to talk about all 10 people.
No.
It doesn't matter, you know? They're just like, they're speed bumps, death speed bumps, you know, in a way.
That's so funny. That's such a great way to put it. queries have always been something I've struggled hardcore with, because I really have to separate myself as the author of the book. I have to be like, okay, what is, like, boil it down, what do they actually need to know instead of everything in the book? That's not what it's for, and I think that's where a lot of people get hung up, but that is good advice. Boil it down to the basics of what they need.
And I also recommend to authors, when you're writing your book, even if it's a book, even if you already have an agent, when you're writing a book, stop and write a query for it. Especially when you hit that middle part of your book where you suddenly can no longer remember what the hell you're writing. We all do that. And trust me, any author will tell you that the middle sucks.
The middle Nobody is likes so writing hard, middle. Yeah.
Nobody wants to sit there and figure out all the plot points that need to happen in order to propel your character story forward. And so we all get a little lost in the soup sometimes. And that's when writing a query letter, and I have done this for many books when I'm lost, I write the query letter, because the query letter tells you exactly what the kernel of the story is supposed to be. It reminds you of the goal, which is, what does your character want? Why do they want it? You know, what's at stake if they fail? And then the other two pieces to that are, what do they do? Like, what actions do they take, and what obstacles are in the way? And that help you get back on track. You get a little lost in the middle of the book.
That is a really good idea. Because the middles can be so slumpy sometimes, where you're just like, what am I writing? Just get through it until the action starts again. But that's a good idea.
And also, that's where frequently writers give up on projects, right? Yeah. It's in the middle. The first 25,000 words, first 30,000 words, which is, you know, act one, are usually pretty easy because you're establishing those things we just talked about. Who's the main character? What do they want? Why do they want it? What's in their way? What do they do to get around it? What's at stake if they fail?
Yep.
Easy. We all think about those, the answers to those questions, probably before we even sit down to write. That's why we're writing the story. We're like, well, I want to tell this story about this person doing this thing. After that, right, you know, you need to have other characters and challenges and failures and betrayals, all those plot point things that help propel the emotional arc of your character forward.
Right.
And those are sometimes hard to figure out. And usually about that time is when I have no idea for a new book.
That's way more exciting.
Shiny new idea syndrome. Yeah. So like, this book. No. This book. This. I'm going to write this one instead. And then, and then the one that's gotten difficult. And then you skip the new one. But you're eventually going to hit the middle of the new book and have the same problem probably. So
right.
Powering through.
Yes, powering through.
Key.
Yes. So the next question I have for you is a two-parter. What is the hardest part of writing for you, and then what's the hardest part of being an author?
All right. We'll start with the writing part, because the writing part is probably the more difficult part for me.
Yeah.
you know, people fall into two categories, usually. introverts and extroverts. And there are a group of people, like my husband is one of them, that kind of straddles the line between the two.
Right.
But I would say that, you know, when hard pressed, he definitely falls on the introvert side of things. I am not an introvert. I am an extrovert. I always have been. Before I was a writer, I was a performer, I was an opera singer, I worked in television, I've done voiceover work. I'm full emotional exhibitionist, as a friend would say. So the sitting down alone and writing by yourself is challenging.
Yeah.
Difficult for me. And so that's not my biggest challenge, right? Because that's kind of a cop-out. It is difficult to do that. I would say that my biggest challenge as far as the writing part is the romance. Mm. I don't love writing teen romance.
But it's so authentic and genuine all the time.
I know. And look, I love it because I, you know, there's a reason that I reread Pride and Prejudice every few years.
Yeah.
Because it was like a very formative romance that I read when I was young. And I love their romance. You know, even as an adult, I can look back and be like, well, maybe there are some problems there. But, you know, that was like the romance that I strive for. You know, I wanted to find somebody who I click with that well. The problem is that if I look at the people that I dated when I was in high school, like none of these were relationships that I would advocate a teenager, you know, to follow through with on the long term. And I am not saying that you can't find your soulmate at 16. Like, we all know people that have been with their partners for 30 years and they're only 45, you know, like, that's totally out there. Just for me, it was maybe not the best idea. And so because of that, because of my own personal experiences with romance when I was young, I do find it challenging to write and sell teenagers on an idea that this person you're in love with when you're 16 is the person you're going to be with forever. Horror is easier in that regard because it's less about finding your soulmate, more about surviving the night.
Right.
And so the romance is sort of secondary. I love the line in Speed with Sandra Bullock and Keanu Reeves about like relationships that, you know, develop in stressful situations. Because essentially, like, your emotions are so heightened, you know, in a situation like 10 or Murder Trending, that you do sort of bond to the people that you go through it with.
Right.
I'm not saying that, you know, any of my characters' relationships survive, say, college, but but in the moment, I can sell a romance that developed in those, like, if people can survive, you know. Yeah. I can understand selling that romance in the moment. I struggled more with the one sort of rom-com that I wrote, I'm Not Your Pick Dream Girl, which is a very feminist rom-com, so that helps. But at the end, you know, spoiler, but it has a happy ending for our main character. It's the love interest. And, you know, I don't know what happens to them when they go to college. I feel like that would be a difficult relationship to maintain. And so I do struggle with this idea of selling that to teens. But I also remind myself that this is fiction. Right. You know, I'm not writing a self-help guide
how to meet your soulmate.
Exactly. I definitely should. I mean, it took me a long time to figure that piece of my own life out. So I should not be giving advice to anyone. So, you know, the romances in my book tend to be secondary.
Right.
As they should in the kind of books that I write.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I struggle with the most. You know, any sort of kissy romance scenes I probably have saved to the end to write. I don't get excited about writing those scenes. I have tons of offers to do. I'm just not one of them.
Yeah.
I can understand that, though. I think there's a lot of books out there that are very romance-focused, and let them do all the gushy, mushy stuff.
Yeah, and the authors who love doing that and love writing that.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Amazing. Fantastic. Like, I'm so glad that it exists, and that I am not sort of feeling pressure to write that
myself. Yeah, you're not the one responsible for that, so that's good.
Exactly.
Yes.
As far as being an author... I love all of the appearances and sort of the social aspects. I love doing. I don't love reading my work in public, but I don't know a single author that's like, yes, I would love to read out loud my book. But I love doing school events. I love getting in front of readers, whether it's teens or adults. I love doing, you know, the author speed dating events, like all that stuff I love. The problem is probably that I love it a little too much and get in the way of the writing stuff.
Yes.
That sort of challenging alone in the room stuff. Where I have, especially in the past, less so now, I'm mostly because my tie of an 8-month-old son now, who you might have heard crying in the background as my husband desperately tries to keep him calm. My time is more stretched these days with my own family, and so I have to say no to more events than I used to. So I'm better at balancing the writing and the social family than I used to be. But that's definitely a challenge for me, is making sure that I protect the writing time.
Yeah.
So that I don't end up, you know, 2 weeks before a book is due, having to write 30,000 words or some ludicrous.
That would be great. Sure. Yeah, that'd be a real tight timeline.
That would suck a whole lot.
Yes, it would. So on the flip side of that, what's the best part for you of being a writer and being an author?
The best part of this whole thing are other people. And you're probably going to hear that from almost every author.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in the YA community. You know, I came from a performing arts background, and I have amazing, wonderful opera singer friends who are very dear to me. The problem, though, is that, say, if you and two of your friends all audition for the same show, and one of them gets cast, that means that the other two of you did not.
Yeah.
And so while you can be happy for them, there's also a piece of you that is maybe a little jealous, maybe a little resentful, something, right?
For sure.
There is no one role to be cast in publishing. Just because your friend gets a big book deal does not necessarily mean that you will not. Even if you write books in the same genre, even if you write similarly themed books in the same genre,
right?
There is room for a variety of vampire books and contemporary romance and girls that like sports and girls that like science and boys that like boys and girls that like girls. Like, there's room for all of that. There's not just one book, right? There's not just one author doing that. There's lots of authors doing lots of things.
Yeah.
I'm not the only YA horror author out there. I'm not the first. I won't be the last. There's room for all of us. And because of that, authors can be supportive. No, I'm not saying that there's not still jealousy. There's plenty of it. I've felt it. You know, would I love to get that huge book deal where they send me on an international tour and all that? Absolutely. But I also know that there are authors that would love to be in my position as well. I've had a TV movie made out of one of my books. I have a series coming to Netflix and the BBC next year based on two books. Like, I understand how lucky I am and how much people love to have that. So jealousy is always going to sort of be there.
Yeah.
There's a difference between being jealous and being envious.
Yeah.
And jealousy can be healthy, envy not as much. So I can be friends with so many YA authors, both that write, you know, horror like myself and that do not, and we can be supportive and we can go to each other's book signings and we can buy each other's books and be genuinely happy for their success. One of my very close friends, you know, just sold a huge sold to Netflix and a huge deal. It's going to be a huge series. I am so happy for her. Another one of my friends won the National Book Award 2 years ago. I could not have been more thrilled for her. That is amazing in any industry to feel that much love and support for your colleagues. I feel incredibly, incredibly lucky to be with this group of primarily women, but some male authors, but primarily like fierce, supportive women.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah, I think that is one of the things about the writing community that is amazing. Everybody's supportive of each other. If somebody gets an agent, you know, in my circle, that's super exciting and great. And while, yes, like, oh, I would love to have an agent too, you know, I'm excited and happy for her because there's lots of other agents and it doesn't mean that I'm never going to get one, you know?
Also, I prefer people to my agent all the time. I love her and I want other people to be able to work with her too. And she doesn't sign all of them, but like anybody who's got foot in a door, it's not like they're blocking the entrance for the rest of you. Trust me, they're holding that door
open. Yeah. They're holding it open with all their strength to let as many people in as they possibly can.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you know what? The authors who aren't like that, people know. Yeah. You know, people know the authors that are not supportive, that are maybe not always speaking kindly about everyone in private. and we know, you know, but for the most part, it's an amazing group.
It is. I think that's one thing that's my favorite is I've just, before I even started my podcast, just on Twitter, found this really great community of people who I use as, you know, critique partners, but also who I just have become close friends in non-writing ways, too, and that's pretty special. Like, people I haven't even met in real life, which is so cool.
Yes. And my, you know, when I was first querying, I found a group of writers on a message board at Absolute Right that I'm still friends with. That's many of them have awesome. Critiqued my books. Some of them have become published. Some of them are not. Some of them are self-published. Some of them are big New York Times bestsellers. Some are, you know, plugging along like me. But I'm still friends with all of them. Yeah. And that's pretty special.
Yeah, super special. I think it's definitely something unique about the writing world. And I think something, too, that I've always thought is that, like you were talking about earlier, writing is such a alone time thing. We sit at our computers by ourselves and write, and it's nice to connect with other people who know that same struggle of being
for sure. my non-writer friends, and I have many of them, and I love them all dearly, but when I'm on deadline, they don't get it.
Yeah. They're like, wait, you have to sit and write? That doesn't make any sense. My husband struggles with it sometimes too, and I'm like, no, I need to do this.
Yes. Thankfully, I have a husband that's like, you know, he's the type of person that's incredibly supportive no matter what. It does help, I think, that I was already published when we met. My first book had just come out when we met. So he sort of has only known
that
fresh periodic deadlines. But he's also, you know, the type of person who's just very supportive and not resentful when I have to lock myself in a room for 16 hours to hit the lines.
Yes. I just remind my husband, I'm like, well, you want me to get a book deal someday, right? Like, you want me to be able to do this, so let me do it.
This is it. This is the gig. And trust me, when you get the book deal, that becomes more intense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your writing style. Are you more of a pantser, more of a planner, or something kind of in between or different?
I used to describe myself as strictly a plotter, and I think for the type of books that I write where the mystery and the killer and the reveal of both of those things is incredibly important, like they are the story, not just the plot, they are the story, you know, knowing where you're going, knowing who the killer is, knowing why it is they're doing what they're doing before you start writing the book is incredibly important.
Yeah.
If you get to the end of the book and don't know who the killer is in a murder mystery, you have a problem.
That's a big problem.
So Yes, exactly. So I always, from the beginning, I always knew where the book was heading. I always knew what the end game would be. Who the killer was, why they were doing it. And then, of course, once you know that, the key of a murder mystery, and this is a lesson I learned from Agatha Christie, you have to introduce everybody, including the killer, within the first couple of chapters. You know, you can't bring in the killer later on as, you know, so it's a character that we don't care about as much, right? It's gotta be somebody that we know right off the bat. So you get everybody in the pool, you know, near the beginning of the book. What you have to do then is shine the suspect light on everybody. Everyone has to be a suspect at some point. And the key with a really good murder mystery is that the reader will at some point suspect the actual killer, but then dismiss them from the suspect list. And I see this a lot, especially with 10. And 10's a unique case, and I won't explain why because I don't want to ruin it. Right. I haven't read it. But 10 is a unique case in that regard. But it's true in all of my books. You need to dismiss the potential killer or the real killer as a suspect early on, so that when it's revealed who it was, it makes perfect sense. You're like, yes, I knew it, but then I, the best mysteries have that element. And so then you sort of work backwards, right? So now you know who the killer is, so you work backward, and you need to plan these scenes where things are learned, facts are uncovered, people are suspected, other people die, and sort of who dies and how is sort of dictated by these certain plot points that you need to establish for your main character unraveling the mystery along the way.
Yeah.
That feels very utilitarian to a lot of writers. Like, oh, that doesn't sound fun at all. But for me, it's like a puzzle, you know, piecing together. I don't know, you know, how many pieces are in the puzzle. I don't know if it's a 20-piece puzzle or a 500-piece puzzle, but I know the image I'm trying to create. And so I work backwards. There is, however, a lot of room for creativity as I go. So I have usually a pretty tightly plotted first act, which, you know, as I said earlier, is like the who, the what, the why, right. You know. And then I know what happens at the end. And then I have these sort of tentacles that I need to hit all along the way. I need to have a big scene where XYZ happens, and I need to have this secret that's uncovered and this betrayal. And then I kind of figure out how those things come into play as I read. So there is still room for discovery, but it's mostly like within the framework of a plot.
Yeah. I love it. That's smart. I think especially in that genre and having, like you said, you have to know kind of beforehand and be able to plant the seeds of everything to make sure that it makes sense, because otherwise you'll have a really confused reader at the end.
You're going to have a hot, hot mess.
Yes.
By the time you get to the end.
So you mentioned before that you've kind of done a lot of things, opera singer, voiceover artist, been in, you know, worked in television. How did your love of writing and storytelling begin?
That's a good question, because I do this when I do school visits. The first thing I say is, how many of you are writers? Or no, actually, I say, how many of you are storytellers? And like five people raise their hands, right?
Yeah.
Because people assume storyteller means writer. And then I tell them, like, you know, that's wonderful, but I wasn't one of you. Just true. I was not a writer, and I did not consider myself a storyteller. I was always a performer. I didn't write as a child. I didn't write in high school. I didn't even keep a journal. Like, I'm just not that introspective.
Journaling is so hard, though. I can't journal.
Journaling is very
hard. Yeah.
But I didn't write stories. I wasn't doing any of those things when I was young. I was doing all of my storytelling on a stage. Yeah. And I was a dancer that turned to a singer. I have a BA in vocal performance from UCLA. I have a master's of music and opera performance from the Maryland Opera Studio. That's my whole life, was performing and reading. which I think is the key, right? I was always a reader from a young age. But there's a teacher, for God's sake. Like, we were always at the library.
Yes.
I read and I read and I read and I read and I read. And still, to this day, less so than I would like, but still a big reader. And so, along the way, life happens. And as far as the opera goes, I just wasn't good enough. Bottom line, I just wasn't good enough to make a living at it.
Yeah.
And then I was working in television with my now ex-husband. He's a TV show creator and writer, and I was producing the shows and doing voiceover work on his cartoons, and that's all awesome.
Yeah.
Until we split up.
So that kind of ended then.
Stopped doing that. And that was when I sort of hit a low point. I was not singing anymore. I was not producing his TV shows anymore. Sort of all of these things that I'd used to define myself over the years had been stripped away, and I was really lost. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I woke up one day and I was like, oh, write a novel. Which I did. I wrote that horrible rom-com.
You always have to write a horrible book, though. Like,
of course. God, you got to learn how to do it, man.
Yes.
The important part of that story is that I wrote it.
Yeah.
You know? What a whole manuscript. And while it sucked, I had fallen in love with storytelling as fiction, right? Long fiction. And what I have discovered over the years, which I didn't know then, but I know now, is that while I was not always a writer, I was always a storyteller. I was telling stories on stage, through acting. You know, the whole show versus tell of fiction is what you do on stage. You have to show everything. When I teach writing, I teach a lot of acting Stanislavski technique in terms of writing, which is these five things I've been harping on throughout this interview, which is, you know, who's the character? What do they want? Why do they want it? What's in their way? What do they do to get around it? What's if they fail? The objective, the motivation, the obstacle, the action, and the stakes.
Yeah.
Just Stanislavski's fundamental questions for actors. It's the same thing with fiction, right? You're just writing all of it out. You're writing all of the internal monologue. You're not showing it through action. An actor can't speak their internal monologue, right? They have to show it by how they walk, how they hold their body, you know, how they deliver a line. We have the benefit of being able to show that through our character's thought, right? But it's the same bloody thing. And I had a very quick learning curve because I'd always been storytelling. And the reality of storytelling is that it's not just written word, right? Storytelling is acting and singing and composing music and painting and sewing and creating a recipe and designing video games and drawing graphic novels and comics. All of it is storytelling. All of it is presenting a narrative.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of a presentation to a group of teens, then I say, how many of you are storytelling? Almost everybody in the room raised their hand. Right? Because you just have to think of story in terms of all of the ways that it can be expressed, not just writing words on a page.
Right.
When you do that, it seems much less intimidating. And that's what I learned. Right? That is my journey towards writing, which is I wasn't always a writer, but I was always a storyteller.
I love that. That's awesome. What a great, I don't know what word I'm trying to use, but I think a great, you know, overview of what storytelling is, because I do think a lot of people think about it as just writing, but yeah. There's stories
just
all around us.
Write a story.
Yeah, that's awesome. Again, on the writing vein, what does your revision process look like? How do you go through and make sure you've got all those plot points for your murder mystery, make sure you've got everything, you know, the way it needs to be?
Oh, you know, it's such a hard thing because I feel like so much of the revision process is voodoo. And by that I mean, it's happening in your brain while you don't realize that it's happening in your brain.
Yeah.
So you've presented yourself with a series of problems that need to be solved. And some of that, you actively come up with a game plan. I'm all about bullet points and like organizing my thoughts in easy bullet points. And,
yes.
And as I'm drafting or reading through a draft, I just make notes of stuff I need to fix. And then later I'll organize them sort of in the way that's easiest to tackle them, whether it's chronological or dealing with sort of the spot check things first. Like you got to add a mention of this here or cut a mention there. Go through, fix that. Some of it is like you do a big read through and you have to keep these 10 things in mind as you go, which feels impossible, and that's how your brain manages to do it. But I just keep that bullet point list printed out right next to me so I can be like, oh, what am I supposed to be looking for as I read through this? And, you know, being able to parse through edit notes, whether it's from a critique partner or from an editor, is an art form in and of itself. Being able to read a 10 or 12 page edit letter and then create my bullet points from that, I need to keep in mind. It's something that takes a week, you know. I don't just get an edit letter. I'm like, here I go. I need to look about it and let it simmer with the game plan. But there is this sort of like behind the scenes magic that's happening that I can't quite quantify. That a lot of cues. But it's something that like your brain chews on a problem in the background. The computer's running a program in the background, you yes. know? And so while I try to keep organized with my bullet points, my brain is just like working things out, and then I'll be like brushing my teeth in the morning and I'll be like, oh, that's how I fix that.
Right.
And I used to stress a lot about being able to fix all the problems. I won't be able to fix the problems with this book. Maybe it'll fail me this time. Maybe my Scooby sense will not work this time or whatever. But you know what? It always does. I feel like we have to trust ourselves a little bit and not, you know, not grip so hard on those revisions. We've just got to make it perfect. There's no perfect.
No.
It's so done. I mean, done is when I can't read it anymore without wanting to vomit all over my keyboard. That's how I know I'm done.
Yes.
But I'll read a published novel of mine and be like, oh, I wish I could fix that. But I can't. It's done. It's out the door.
Yeah.
You know, this is why I would be a horrible self-published author, because I would just, like, want to tinker with it, like, as opposed to
you'd have like you'd have like 10 editions of your book.
No, it would be awful. You just gotta let it go. And I think trusting yourself and your editor is really key.
Yeah, I think revisions, you can get lost in the process of editing your book down to something you don't even recognize that, you know, you didn't mean for it to be, because you're just like, oh no, I can change this and change that. I definitely think that's a slippery slope.
And make it perfect.
Yes.
Just, you know, release the idea that there's a perfect. There's no perfect.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the sort of thing where you got to get it to where you think it's good enough, but, you know, realizing that it's not going to be perfect for everybody. Like all books, not everybody is a fan of them.
Yeah, and, you know, if you're ever really worried about that, go on Goodreads and read reviews of, you know, any book that's recognized either as a classic or, you know, a multi-award winning book, read the reviews.
Yeah.
Because trust me, you're going to find one-star reviews that were like, meh.
This makes you feel so much better. This book wasn't that writing. Great. Yeah. It was poorly written. Yeah.
So you're like, yeah, To Kill a Mockingbird, like, super overrated, you know? Why does anybody care? God, Atticus is such a pain. No. It's out there, trust me.
Yes. So, I have one last question for you. It's my favorite question. What is your favorite book or books right now? This isn't like your all-time favorite, but just something you've read recently that you really loved.
I'll give you two. One is nonfiction and one is fiction.
Okay.
The nonfiction first. I just finished a book called The Secret Rooms. which had been in my wish list forever, and I finally just bought. And it's about a journalist who was gone to a castle, England, to research basically what happened to the old kind of Downton Abbey structure of landowners and tenants and villages that existed before World War One, and how that system was completely decimated by the First World War because a whole generation of men died, you know. And so after the war, there weren't farmers to work fields and, you know, blacksmiths to you know, these jobs that people had been working for generations because they just did what their father did. Like, the whole system was blown to pieces. And this Duke who had fought in World War I and, you know, died in the 40s had meticulously collected records of letters from his family. And so he had this huge well-known archive, and this journalist got permission to go research it for her book. She discovered, however, was this family mystery where, you know, months worth of correspondence had been meticulously excised from the record. And then this whole mystery of how the Duke spent literally his dying moments in this archive trying to basically burn things.
Wow.
And so her book became not about what happened to the sort of estate farmer system after World War One, but about this family and this mystery, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Like, if you're a Downton Abbey fan, if you're a fan of, like, secret rooms and family secrets, I highly recommend it. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And then the fiction that I just finished reading it, of course, it's my favorite book is always, like, the last book I read.
Yeah, mine too.
It's called The Silent Companions by Laura Purcell. And I'm an adult gothic novel kick, and this one's fantastic. It's set in the 19th century, and told in multiple timelines, and part of it is about a newly married woman who goes to her husband's estate, and some really dark, and he died. I'm not spoiling it. Like, he went out to prepare the house and dies there, like, right after they get married, and she's going out there to bury him, and then horrible, horrible things ensue.
Wow.
But it's got all of the, like, dark, creepy manor house stuff that I love, and a wonderful mystery that unfolds, and some dark, twisted things that happen. I loved it. So if you've got a hankering for a good gothic novel, I highly recommend.
Yeah, that one sounds awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Gretchen, thank you so much for being on the podcast and for chatting with us about you and all your amazing books. And everybody make sure to go buy Murder Funding. It is going to be amazing. But thank you so much, Gretchen.
Thank you for having me. I had a wonderful time.
All right, guys, how amazing was Gretchen? Don't you just love her? So make sure you go and buy Murder Funding and Murder Trending if you haven't read it. They're not connected based on the characters. You could read the second one first, but you probably understand the worlds a little bit more if you read the first one. And go and read everything she's read. 10 is amazing. It's such a cool book. But as always, my lovely friends, please make sure to rate and review this podcast. It is super helpful to me, and I know it might seem like not a big deal, but if you don't rate and review, tweet about it, post about it, retweet what I tweet so that more people get to see and learn and connect with each other. Feel free to always DM me at Rose Quinney on Instagram and Twitter. And other than that, I'll be hearing you guys. I never know how to end this, but I will have another episode out next week, and it is a literary agent, and you're gonna love it. So, alrighty, guys, see ya.